Welcome back. When a faceless, hair-covered entity emerged from the wooded hills of Louisiana, Missouri on July 11, 1972, no one could have predicted the terror and frenzy that would follow. The apparent beast, which walked upright and carried the remains of a dead animal, was first spotted by three young witnesses as it lurked in the shadows of Marzolf Hill behind their home. Within a short time, others caught glimpses of the hairy thing as it stalked the countryside, while eerie lights were seen streaking across the sky. Stories of the strange phenomena quickly made headlines across America. Legend hunter and author Lyle Blackburn recalls the incredible and frightening story of Momo, the Missouri Monster, next on Coast to Coast AM. Lyle Blackburn is a native Texan known for his work in writing, music, film, and cryptid research. He's the author of several acclaimed books, including The Beast of Boggy Creek and Lizard Man, whose subject matter reflects his lifelong fascination with legends and sighting reports of unknown creatures. Lyle is also the founder of the rock band Ghoul Town, columnist for the horror magazine Rumorgue, and narrator-producer of documentary films, including The Mothman of Point Pleasant and Boggy Creek Monster, in which he also appears on screen. When Lyle isn't writing books, hunting monsters, or performing with his band, he can be found speaking at various cryptozoology conferences and horror conventions around the United States. His latest offering, and it's another good one, is Momo, The Strange Case of the Missouri Monster. Lyle Blackburn, welcome back to Coast to Coast AM. How are you, my friend?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
You know, prior to your book coming out and being approached by your publicist, I was not even familiar with this story, Momo. Did it somehow get sort of lost in the shuffle, or is it truly not as, let's say, widespread as known as, let's say, the Lizard Man or the Beast of Boggy Creek?
Well, you know, some of those stories, you know, had more publicity. I mean, certainly with the Beast of Boggy Creek, it was associated with the movie The Legend of Boggy Creek, which was a phenomenon in the 70s and well-known. Momo is definitely more regional, but it was covered in a lot of newspapers back in the early 70s, and it's become one of those kind of classic Bigfoot tales, for most of the classifications. But I, you know, anytime you see one of these maps of cryptids around America, Momo is always represented for Missouri. So, among cryptozoology buffs and some paranormal enthusiasts, it's certainly a story that's well known and one that I felt needed, a thorough investigation in a book, because it's mentioned here and there in other publications and even been covered on TV, but nobody had ever written a comprehensive book on it.
And anytime there is a creature described as tall, hairy, and bipedal, it automatically gets categorized as Bigfoot, but not necessarily so with Momo, as we'll discover. But first of all, Lyle, if you would, give us a bit of a thumbnail sketch of this little small Mississippi River town of Louisiana, Missouri, which is kind of confusing. It's the name of a state and a city.
Right. Yeah, I found quickly writing a book that had a city called Louisiana was kind of a challenge. But it's located in the eastern portion of Missouri, a little bit north of center, and right there on the edge of the Mississippi River, which separates Missouri from Illinois. And, you know, it's a small riverside town. Most of the commerce back in the day came from riverside trade up and down the Mississippi there. And it's not far from where Mark Twain, you know, had the setting for Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. So it's kind of that, you know, quintessential American location, and one that you usually wouldn't associate with a hairy monster. But a sleepy little town, and it's still a small town today.
And the family really at the center of the Momo, Missouri Monster sighting, the Harrisons. Tell me about what happened that day, July 11th, 1972. Take us back. We've got 8-year-old Terry and his brother Wally, 5.
Right. They lived there in Louisiana, and the Harrisons lived in an area that backed up to this hill called Marzoff Hill, a heavily wooded place. And Terry and Wally were playing out there that afternoon on July 11th, and they looked up to see this large hair-covered creature standing there looking at them. It apparently come out of the woods from the hill, and of course, immediately they were frightened. It didn't advance. It was just sort of looming there, staring at them, and they immediately ran towards the house, and in the fuss running inside, their older sister, Doris, who was in the bathroom, could see out the window. She also very clearly saw this thing standing there and, of course, was concerned for her brothers. Doris described it as being, you know, tall. She said it looked, appeared to have no neck. It had a large, what she described as a pumpkin-sized head, and it was covered in hair, and it appeared to be carrying what they later surmised was a dead dog. And so, of course, once the brothers scrambled in the house, they quickly called their mother, who then called their father at work and said, you know, the kids had seen something in the backyard, and please get over there now. And he went over there, and that's really where it all started publicly once that incident made it to the newspaper.
Right. And the physical description, how tall? And how did they describe the build of this creature?
It was bulky. It was at least as tall as a man. It definitely stood upright. It was on two legs. They couldn't see its face because the hair, they said, was longer on top and just fell across the face. They didn't see eyes. It was quite an ominous looking thing, especially because it was somewhat faceless. And, they said the head was rather large, which is, gives it some unique characteristic and a little bit something that's not normally reported in, say, a standard Bigfoot sighting. While it fit that sort of upright, hairy, hominoid kind of Bigfoot description, it did have those unique characteristics.
And was there an odor?
Yes, Terry and Wally said that they could smell just a terrible odor coming off the thing, and that would be reflected in other later sightings as well. So it was something that was associated with that initial sighting, that it smelled bad.
And the dog, the dead dog, that Momo was supposedly clutching, did it appear as if the creature had killed this animal or dug it up? I mean, what state was this dead animal in?
Yeah, whatever it was holding wasn't moving, Terry, the older of the two boys, thought, at first he thought it was maybe a baby that it was carrying, but as he looked at it, he said he thought perhaps it was a dead dog. It was sort of lifeless, just hanging over the creature's forearm. So, that was something that sort of also created a sort of an ominous thing, because if it was, it truly was a dead dog, that was kind of creepy unto itself.
And the Harrison's own dog, their family dog, was adversely affected as well. Tell me about that.
Right, yeah, just immediately, just other strange things started happening. When their father, Edgar Harrison, got home from work and started investigating, looking into this, he noticed later on that evening that their own dog became sick and was vomiting, was ill, and, can't be sure that it had any connection to the sighting, it was certainly coincidental and, just sort of, like I said, was some of the first things that, begin to happen that were residual, very high strangeness type incidents.
And the father, Edgar Harrison, he's a reputable man in town. He's a pastor or a deacon, I think, at the local Pentecostal church. What kind of investigation did he do immediately upon getting home?
Well, when he got home, of course, he listened to the children and, felt that, they were obviously telling the truth, it wasn't something they were making up for any reason. And he went out in the back and looked in the area where the boys said it was standing, And he could see where, you know, something had walked around, vague footprints, nothing really clear, but he also found some branches and things where it looked like the creature had walked out in and out of the woods there. And so, you know, all in all, he definitely felt like his kids had seen something, and this sort of became something that, you know, he wanted to investigate and just find out what it was.
And, I mean, 1972, obviously they didn't have DNA testing, but was he able to, I don't know, collect any hair samples? Was there any scat lying around?
Right, yeah, I think he found some hair. It obviously at the time it just, you know, was things that sort of added up to show that something was there, but, you know, it wasn't something they thought, you know, we should collect and anything of that nature. It was just all things that sort of verified that, you know, seemingly some kind of hairy animal had been lurking there in the backyard.
And, I mean, it doesn't stop there, obviously. This would go on for a little while, but that same afternoon, July 11th, just a few blocks away, another sighting. This was a woman, I believe her name was Mrs. Clarence Lee. Tell me about her sighting.
Right. You know, once this, kind of word got out, I mean, it's a small town, so things got around quickly. Miss Clarence Lee said she had first heard a terrible, like, growling animal sound coming in from the vicinity of the Harrison home. And even another couple said they had heard something as well. And it was reported that she saw some sort of a, you know, large, you know, figure run across the road. And so it was, you know, perhaps the same thing the Harrison kids had seen.
And meanwhile, has anyone at this point reported a missing dog?
No one had reported one, but of course, as things got on and the story got out, and you know that the kids had seen what they thought was a dead dog, people, you know, then came forward and said, you know, yeah, we, you know, our dog's been missing for a couple of weeks, and so that, you know, added further credibility that perhaps the creature had, if it was a creature, had taken, you know, these people's dogs. So there were dogs missing and a dog seen. So.
And so back to Edgar Harrison, the deacon at the Pentecostal church. A few days later, he's holding, I guess, a regularly scheduled prayer meeting at his house, and a number of people in attendance. What does he and his congregation, if I can use that word, what do they witness?
Well, they had, had the prayer meeting at the house, and, you know, it was done, and there was about a dozen of them standing outside the Harrison home, you know, kind of talking and so forth before everybody left. And suddenly they saw what they described as several balls of light coming from east to west and moved across the trees, and then saw what they described as a white and green light go down in the vicinity of a school nearby. It appeared, they didn't describe them necessarily as being craft or anything in the sky. They were just balls of light, which, you know, they all clearly saw, you know, multiple witnesses. And so that was, you know, something that just sort of started adding to the air of mystery going on there in the small town.
And did they also hear or believe they heard from that creature again that same night?
Yeah, corresponding with that, they heard something that first sounded like a loud growl, and then something that, you know, it was like a clanging sound or something coming off Mars off Hill, and it got louder and louder, and the growling and the clanging, and definitely something that frightened them, you know, at that point.
And if I'm remembering from your book correctly, the top of Marzolf Hill, where the sound was coming from, there was some sort of a water reservoir up there. Was that the source of the sound, as if something or someone was, I don't know, banging against the reservoir or throwing rocks at the reservoir?
Right. Yeah. There was in. You know, from the sound of what they heard in the clanging sound, they surmised that, you know, it could have perhaps been something hitting on that reservoir, you know, when combined with the loud growling sounds that they had heard, I mean, it just was, you know, something that they just scared everybody.
Now, at this point, is Edgar Harrison contemplating going up to the top of Marzolf Hill to investigate, or what does he decide to do at that point?
Yeah, you know, within this time period, you know, Edgar had sort of gone up and down the hill there, and certainly, you know, having, you know, being that it was a wooded area and the creature had been seen there, you know, naturally assumed that, you know, it could be living there or roaming on Marzolf Hill. So he had gone up and sort of investigated, you know, up and down. It was kind of some, you know, vague trails that went up behind the house, you know, things that kids roamed around on. And so he had followed those around just looking for, you know, footprints or signs of anything. And he would, you know, go up there with, as things progressed, you know, some reporters and other people would come to town, and he would, you know, take them up the hill, and they would, you know, investigate that.
And at this point, I guess we cue the pitchforks and the torches. It's like a scene like from something like Frankenstein's monster. This mob assembles. Tell me about that.
Right. Well, you know, this evening when they saw the lights and heard the growling sound, I mean, it was so loud that the Miss Harrison just came out of the house with all the kids in tow and was screaming at Edgar, you know, let's get out of here, get the kids in the car. You know, the kids were in a frenzy. And so by this time, most of the other parishioners had taken off and, you know, gotten out of there as well. And so the Harrisons begin to take off down the street in their car. And as they were going, basically their street dead ended into Marzolf Hill. So as they're going out of there, they look and there's basically a mob of, you know, 30, 40 people coming up towards the hill, you know, alarmed at what they were hearing. All the neighbors had, you know, gathered together. And according to the story, Miss Harrison sort of leaned out the window and said something like, they're coming. And, you know, the mob just all started running. I mean, it's like a scene out of a movie. You couldn't even have made this stuff up. And this just was, you know, kind of like you say, that the torches and pitchforks, the villagers are coming for the monster. And then something frightening happens, and she screams, and they all run the other way. So this is just things that would be recorded in the old newspapers as it progressed.
Mass hysteria, perhaps? Or, you know, did they all hear and see something? That's, I guess, a question for the ages. But it's lucky, you know, no one got hurt. I mean, it could have gone south really fast. Lyle Blackburn is with us, the author of Momo, The Strange Case of the Missouri Monster. And we will open up the phone lines at the top of the hour, take questions and comments. And, I mean, but let me ask you as we head into the break, just very quickly, to your mind, does this fit into sort of a typical Bigfoot Sasquatch sighting, or is there something else going on here?
Well, you know, in some ways it's indicative of Bigfoot sightings, you know, just sort of a, in general, you know, an upright, hairy creature that people see. But when you add in the extra high, strange kind of things with the lights being seen, and, you know, people would later hear disembodied voices and, you know, the growling and all this other stuff going on in the region, it certainly seemed that it wasn't your typical, you know, Bigfoot, you know, case.
That's for sure. All right, we'll come back and discuss further. And I'll be back in the air chair again tonight, Sunday night into Monday morning, until I get it right. Chronicler of the strange and weird and paranormal, Steve E. Asher, will join me in the first hour to discuss paranormal Western Kentucky, in particular, the haunting of the St. Vincent Academy. And then in the final 3 hours, Don Jeffries, author of Hidden History, you know, the one with the foreword by Roger Stone. Well, he's back with another hefty tome, this time examining crimes and cover-ups in American politics, 1776 to 1963. That's tonight, Sunday night into Monday morning on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you from In-Depth Radio News Talk 1010, Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate. Lyle Blackburn stays with us as he recalls the terror for several weeks in the summer of 1972 in Louisiana, Missouri. And we talked about this this mob, this vigilante monster hunter mob that descended on Marzolf Hill. I guess it was around July the 14th. The first sighting was July the 11th. But this goes on for several more weeks, I guess. Just kind of give us a chronology of the various sightings, encounters, you know, for the rest of July, the high points, if you could, Lyle.
Okay, yeah, definitely after that, you know, people became aware there was something going on. And other people would report things to either the police or the news outlets. You know, most of the time the calls came into the sheriff's office, and, you know, they, you know, at first the sheriff, the chief of police, you know, was suspicious about what people were reporting. But the more the, you know, reputable local citizens began to say that they had seen something strange, he definitely thought there was something to it. You know, a few days after, you know, the mob incident, a couple of boys spotted what they said was a hairy, upright creature standing in the woods on Marzolf Hill. You know, another woman said she had seen a thing cross the highway. Another resident said he had seen something that appeared to be carrying a sheep or a dog in its mouth. So here was another incident where the creature, if it was the creature, appeared to be carrying an animal. This, you know, about a week later, the chief of police decided, you know, it was best to organize a posse and to go up on the Marzolf Hill and take a look for themselves. So he organized a group of about 20 men, which included, you know, quite a few police officers, a state conservation officer, and even Edgar Harrison. And they pretty much combed the woods of Marzolf Hill looking for any sign of this creature, which unfortunately they didn't find anything. You know, as things came out in the newspapers, another a local farmer said that prior to the Harrison incident, he had seen some sort of a dark humanoid figure which appeared to be covered in hair, going across his field one morning. And stories began to come out like this, where people had apparently seen the thing prior to the Harrison. So it appeared that, you know, that wasn't the first incident. It was just the first that became known. And of course, the newspapers began to report this. It was picked up in the Associated Press. I mean, there was so much news coverage in a very short time within that month of July. And the incidents just sort of continued from there and expanded as some local paranormal researchers came to town looking into it, which really the first kind of response to that was some of the MUFON investigators came. And, you know, because of the strange lights that had been seen, there wasn't that many, you know, so-called Bigfoot hunters or cryptozoologists around at the time. So it was mostly investigated by UFO researchers who, you know, believe there could have been a connection between the sightings of the lights and the creature itself. So some of the ancillary sightings and stuff were recorded by them, fortunately, which kind of complemented all the incidents that were reported in the newspapers.
Now, aside from the lights that were seen, I believe the night of July the 14th at the Harrison home, by Edgar Harrison and his congregation, were there any other strange lights in the sky?
Yeah, towards the end of July, several witnesses spotted what they described as a fireball or something. It appeared to hover over some trees there on the bluffs, which overlooked the Mississippi River. And there was there's a railroad track that runs there as well, in the location where a local resident had seen the pretty clearly seen the creature across that area. And towards the end of July, they were seeing strange lights up there. On the subsequent day, they saw more colored lights hovering over this bluff. And they said the lights, you know, appeared to be signaling back and forth, things like that, which, you know, made them assume that these weren't just random lights. They were something that, again, not necessarily described as, you know, any sort of a ship or aircraft, but definitely something odd and definitely something that, you know, wasn't, you know, normally seen there. So this again added to the whole air of mystery going on.
And again, this is, we're talking 46 and a half years ago. So, you know, not a lot of people walking around with cameras necessarily at all hours of the night. But did anyone have the presence of mind to snap a picture of either the lights or this creature?
Unfortunately not. You know, this is a case where, you know, apparently nobody had a camera, and certainly most of the people that saw it, you know, from kids or local residents, you know, definitely didn't have cameras on them and things like that. So there's no, you know, unfortunately there's no alleged pictures of the creature or even the lights.
And I don't know if they had a community newspaper. I know AP picked up on the story, but locally, the local media, were they treating this seriously, or was it one of those sort of, you know, ha-ha, tongue-in-cheek kind of treatments in the newspaper?
Well, you know, a little bit of both. I mean, they did report it as it came in. I mean, they weren't shy about, you know, detailing the monster hunt and things like that, but it definitely was something of a, you know, okay, you know, they found nothing again, that sort of thing. And the newspapers had dubbed the creature Momo, and that comes from the abbreviation for Missouri, which is M-O, and then monster, M-O, so Momo. Kind of sounded a little cuddly, but obviously the description of the creature was far from cuddly. But, you know, the newspaper there, you know, it resulted in the town, you know, a lot of people were coming to town. It was attracting tourism, and the local businesses quickly adopted some advertising campaigns that incorporated a monster, some crazy drawings next to their ads in the newspaper, and I mean, which was kind of ironic because this creature was kind of a foul-smelling, dead dog-carrying thing, and then it would be used to advertise, you know, a hamburger special at the local burger restaurant. So if you look through those old papers, you've got these real crazy-looking ads, but, you know, the locals, whether it was, you know, a real creature or whatever, they did kind of embrace and capitalize on some of the attention they were getting, and certainly, you know, drawing in tourists, which was very unusual. This, nothing like that ever went on in this small town.
But as you say, you know, it's kind of a cute and cuddly name, Momo, but there was a palpable fear in this town. I mean, were people literally like afraid to be in their beds at night or to look out the window?
Yeah, definitely. In a lot of cases, you know, and I've talked to, you know, locals who lived there at the time and you know, people who've gone up and just described what their parents were feeling. And yeah, everybody was definitely on the edge. And, you know, a lot of the people, you know, were kind of closing their shades and their doors. And when anything happened, I mean, they were taking it seriously enough. There was, you know, some strange three-toed footprints that had been found. And in one case, you know, they decided to cast them with plaster. I mean, they were treating it quite, you know, seriously, and the locals, you know, like in any of these cases, you know, a lot of them would say, there's nothing to it, but a good portion of them thought, you know, hey, these are my neighbors, and they say they saw this hairy figure in the woods. I believe them, and certainly people saw something, and so there was this just air of fear and mystery and uncertainty as to what was going on.
Well, the footprints are interesting because three toes, that does not sound like your typical Sasquatch, nor the description of the size of the foot. It doesn't seem to be, quite literally, a big foot. It seems quite average, except for the three toes, right?
Right, yeah. It was definitely something that's unusual, but not completely unheard of. I mean, there's been cases, and a lot of times in the southern parts of the United States, where even in the case of the famous Boggy Creek Monster, there was a line of tracks found, and they had three toes. And this is often associated with these more strange cases of, you know, they're described as Sasquatch-looking creatures, but the footprints don't reflect that sort of five-toed thing that we're familiar with. But there's another, a lot of cases in the early 70s up in Chestnut Ridge in Pennsylvania, where people had seen Bigfoot-like creatures, and they found tracks that had three toes. So, just something different and, you know, unique. And in the case of Momo, you know, you've got three-toed prints, which gave it even a more monstrous kind of vibe.
And it sounds, by all accounts, that this creature, Momo, had kind of an appetite for dead dogs. Didn't someone find some recently buried dogs unearthed?
Right, yeah. When Edgar Harrison and some reporters went up on Marzoff Hill and were exploring off the trails, they found this old shack up there that was kind of dilapidated. And they found what appeared to be evidence of something bedded down in there. And in the vicinity of that, there was a spot where some dogs had been buried. And they noticed that some of them had been dug up or unearthed. And, this was, you know, strange. And they surmised that perhaps the creature, you know, had done this or dug it up. And even when they were looking around that shack, they began to smell this terrible odor. And, you know, they felt, okay, the thing is near. And they had their flashlights out and shining them in the woods. And, you know, they never got their eyes on it. And then the smell sort of dissipated. And then they heard some dogs barking a short distance away, as if the creature had been moving close by and moved on. So, they always seemed a little bit like they were almost there. They were almost going to get a glimpse of it themselves. But that never, you know, never happened for Edgar, which was unfortunate, because you could tell that he wanted to, you know, prove to the world that his kids had seen something. Because in these cases, you know, a lot of people ridiculed the kids and their classmates. Ha ha, you saw a monster. And, you know, it was something that he felt he wanted to justify for his family and vindicate what they had seen.
I'm wondering whether the odor may have come from the dead dogs.
Certainly could have. I mean, you know, and if the wind's blowing this way and that way, if there was, you know, discarded dogs over there in the woods, and the woods up there are thick. I mean, I went up on that hill, obviously, many, many years later, but, man, you know, there's places to, you know, the dogs could have been thrown up there, and that could have been the source of the smell. Any number of things, but definitely it was at least, you know, evidence of something going on up there.
Well, let's get back to the footprints for a moment, because there's one report that you talk about that these footprints, I think in like the middle of a barnyard or something, they just sort of appear in the middle of the field. There's no other tracks leading up to where the footprints begin, and then they just sort of end. Tell me about that.
Right. This was in the first early part of August, and this is the most famous of the footprints that were found. And in this case, essentially, there was a strange noise heard, and the residents of this farm that was close by went out, and they found these bizarre three-toed footprints in the garden. And, you know, it was strange because there was, you know, we really couldn't see a trackway leading up to them or leading away, but they were very clearly appeared to be footprints. And the owner of the farm called the local buddy, who came out and had the wherewithal to bring some plaster, and they cast this track. And it's something that's, you know, still exists today. There's a picture of it in my book, in fact. And so that, you know, that was one thing that sort of added to the to the whole story. Now you've got this casting, a physical specimen of what was alleged to be the footprint. So, but the fact that it, you know, there wasn't a long trackway was just another, you know, puzzling thing to the whole mystery.
And what's your take on that? I mean, do you think that it's possible that these lights were in fact some sort of alien craft, and that, I don't know, Momo hitched a ride? I mean, how else to explain footprints that just stop?
Yeah, well, you know, in that case, you know, without giving too many spoilers, but you know, there became clear that, you know, something was going on there. But, you know, and that wasn't the only footprints found. There was others found here and there and various places, and even along the Mississippi River where some farmers had found something which also appeared to be three-toed. And the whole of that put together, seemingly, that something was walking around. And then but the fact that there was the lights, that certainly was something that fueled the early investigators that felt there was a connection, because, you know, here you've got footprints that appear out of nowhere. You've got a creature that people are seeing, but it can't be found in the woods, and lights being seen. So there certainly was some assumptions that there was, you know, the connection.
Well, this story definitely ticks all the boxes, and we'll delve into it further, as well as we'll open up the phone lines, take questions and comments. Would love to hear from people from the Midwest. Perhaps you've had a sighting of a tall, powerfully built, bipedal, hairy creature with a foul smell. Now, taking us into the break, here's George Harrison and Isn't It a Pity on Coast to Coast AM.